You just heard Blondie and then Pretty Things. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio, FM 104.6. And welcome to the UK's only weekly FM radio programme about transport, design and history. It's the Catchcast, and we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our geeky subjects as myself and the guests. In this edition, we're talking about the work of a prominent museum creator who's also become a collector and a seller of beautiful 20th century posters. And I have to warn you that the sound quality on this interview is a little bit ropey, but it's so good what he has to say that hopefully you'll forgive us. Today we're joined by David Bounds. Welcome to the Catchcast, David.
So thank you, Mark.
Thanks for being here, David, and we will speak in detail about your curatorial career in some of the country's best-known museums and your books also. But can we start by taking you back to your upbringing and ask, how did you get so fascinated by history and transport in particular?
So I grew up in the countryside in Cheshire, and my family had been sort of dealers for generations, for hundreds of years, actually. And they've been dealers, they've been grocers and butchers, and had shops, and more recently farm machinery. They also sold antiques. And the legacy of all of this is that the house I grew up in was filled full of old stuff, you know, what curators call material culture. And it wasn't because we were particularly rich. It was just stuff that had been left to us. There was a sense that old things had merit. And as a result, I grew up surrounded by this stuff and was fascinated by the evidence of the past that I could see in my own home, never mind out in museums.
I think some people might be listening to that thinking, crikey, a house full of old relics. But I'm listening to it thinking, my goodness me, you lucky boy.
Well, it did feel like that. And the result was, because my parents put merit on old stuff, I inherited that as a sort of a view of the world, which meant that as a 7 or 8 year old, I was out there digging up Victorian bottle tips and buying books. And it was all about engaging with that past.
Beautiful. And what about things like posters and advertising? Do you remember that in your childhood at all, David?
Well, I was really interested in Victorian advertising, probably so early 20th century stuff. Not so much the later graphic design, which is really where my interests are now. And I was always interested in railway history and transport history. So that led quite sort of seamlessly into an interest in classic railway posters of the 1920s and 30s. But it was much later that I developed an interest or a passion in sort of British graphic design.
Now, I believe you attended not one, but three different universities.
Yeah.
You ended up studying museums. And what was the path to that? How did you go through all your student life?
Well, I suppose like a lot of undergraduates, I didn't really have a very straight idea about what I wanted to do with my life. I was studying history at Sussex because I loved history, not because I saw it as an entry into any sort of career. And it was after I left Sussex that I was working as a volunteer at some museums in Brighton and in Lewes. And one thing led to another, and I ended up doing a postgraduate qualification in history at Manchester, and then later a museum studies qualification at Leicester University. I don't know what it's like at the moment, but back then the thinking was that you needed to get a postgraduate diploma in what's called museum studies if you are serious about working in museums. And Leicester had this reputation for being the sort of leader in social history, which was where my interests were.
And wasn't it in the mid-1990s that you got your first kind of curatorial gig, really?
It was, yeah, at the Imperial War Museum in London. Back then, curators were graded A to G, G being the lowest of the low, and I was a curator grade G, which meant that I sat in a windowless room cataloguing cat badges. But I was absolutely delighted to be working at a national museum. And I still feel very fond about the Imperial War Museum. It's a great museum, not just about military history, but about the sort of social impact of conflict on society.
Yeah, I think you've almost covered what I was going to ask you then, because I don't know if everyone who's listening has been to the Imperial War Museum, but I just wonder if, for those people who haven't been, what the importance of having a museum about wars is, really, in your view?
Well, it was a revelation to me when I went there, because I wasn't that familiar with it as an organisation before. And what I expected was that it would be a museum that would tell you about the history of the British Army and the history of famous battles. But of course, what the Imperial War Museum does is it tells you the story of how conflict affects all of us, but also how it impacts on patterns of migration, how it explains the modern world, the composition of Britain today, and how our military history, and at one time, of course, our empire, still has a resounding legacy. It's a marvellous place to visit.
Puts everything in context, really, doesn't it? Now, you then move to the wonderful location of Carnarvon Castle, I believe.
I did. I got a job as a curator for the Royal Welsh Fusiliers Museum in Carnarvon. Royal Welsh Fusiliers Museum, sadly, has no longer exists. It's been amalgamated to another regiment, but it was Wales's oldest regiment. And it was a particularly interesting place to work because the Royal Welsh Fusiliers has an amazing literary and artistic heritage. The writers Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves were both soldiers in the First World War with the regiment. And more recently, artists like Sir Cuffy Williams and from the past, David Jones, both served with the Royal Welsh. So there was both military history and this great sort of artistic thread as well, which gave that extra dimension to the collection. And Carnarvon, if you have ever been, or if your listeners have ever been, is one of the greatest castles in Britain, an enormous medieval castle on the Seyont River by the Menai, an absolutely amazing place to work.
Well, lucky boy again, I say. Yeah. Today we're discussing the joys of museums and of collecting wonderful historic relics with David Bounds. And we'll get to all that in a moment. But I wonder if you can give us a one-liner about why you think museums are so important to our cultural life, David.
Well, where else can you see these real things from the past and be connected directly with previous generations and see the real thing? I mean, it is such a remarkable experience to have.
It's like time travel, really, isn't it?
It is like time travel. And we used to, you know, AI, we used to see reproductions of stuff. But to, you know, go to the British Museum and look at Saxon helmet or some Egyptian mummy, what an experience that is.
And we have some of the best in the world. I have to warn you that the sound quality on this interview is a little bit ropey, but hopefully you'll forgive us. So you've been working in Wales, but made the transfer back to the English capital in 2002. Tell us what your role was as a curator when you arrived there.
Well, I returned to London as a curator at London Transport Museum. And initially, I was in charge of the incredible photographic archive they've got there, but also the poster collection and what is called ephemera. You know, the sort of printed publicity, printed notices, that sort of stuff.
Oh, lovely. My favourite.
Mine too. I mean, what collection, what incredible stuff. And I joined the museum at a time when it was going through a major lottery-funded redevelopment. So that's a very exciting time to work for a museum because you're literally involved in creating or recreating the narrative of such an organisation and choosing the artefacts that are going to tell that story. So that was a very exciting time, and I worked with some brilliant creative types at London Transport Museum. And then later I became the head curator there, so in charge of everything, including the vehicles and the infrastructure and whatever else.
Because am I right in saying or thinking that not everything a museum has is always on show? So that must have been really exciting for you to be involved in the refit, but also then becoming the head curator.
Yeah, so at a big museum like London Transport Museum, the amount of the collection that's on display at any one time is really small. I mean, you know, less than 1%. Sometimes with like a smaller museum, a local authority place, it might be a bigger proportion of the collection. But I think the public would be surprised just how much stuff is in store. And museums have terrible problems counting how many items they have because, you know, is a bus one item and a box of buttons 350 items? Yeah, it's quite difficult to sort of judge. But a collection like London Transport Museum, it's a million things. I think they actually claim a lower number than that. But they've got a vast store at Acton in West London. And it's mind-boggling, the stuff that they've got there.
Yeah, that must be a real headache for a curator. That conundrum you just outlined, I wouldn't even know where to begin with that. But they are very lucky, aren't they, at the London Transport Museum to have that incredible depot in Acton, which occasionally does open to the public.
That's right. And I think the museum is especially lucky as well that the early versions of London Transport actually collected this stuff at the time. So they collected examples of all of their posters, for example. But the early bus companies that became part of the Underground, they also kept examples of early buses, which they salted away in depots around the capital. And the railways did a similar thing, which is why the National Railway Museum has such a strong collection. Because otherwise, of course, this stuff would have all been scrapped or not saved. And that would be very difficult to recreate today.
And what about some of the biggest or the rarest exhibits that they have squirreled away? What are some of your favourites?
Well, everyone loves the vehicles. If you go to the main museum at Covent Garden, it is overwhelming, the number of sort of buses and tube trains and other things that they've got there. But if you go to the depot, there are ranks of tube trains and like a parking lot of old buses go right back to the earliest times of the horse bus and also trams as well. It's a sort of a visual treat. I think there's something about the physicality of vehicles, isn't there? I mean, you want to get on them, you want to get up close to them, and they really do bring the past to life, I think.
Give them a good sniff.
You do, don't you? I mean, I love to see a restored vehicle, I really do. But sometimes you have an old vehicle that hasn't been fully restored. And when you go into it, you know, it smells like your nana's living room. You've got that old sense of the maquette, that's the fabric that the seats are covered in, the smell of the wood and everything. And yeah, that's very evocative, isn't it, of
isn't
the past?
It? Yeah, absolutely. And David, during this period, I believe you moved into actually writing books about this beautiful stuff. Can you tell us a bit about some of your first books, please?
I love writing about history first and foremost, but also talking about the objects that history has left behind us is a real passion. And I was able to do that at London Transport Museum. I think my first book there was about the Metropolitan Railway, Metroland, a sort of suburban dream of London living. But later I did books about
posters.
And perhaps best of all for me, was I was able to work on the official history of the Underground that celebrated the 150th anniversary in 2013, which was a great occasion with lots of amazing activities that took place in the capital during that year.
Oh my, I remember that very well because I was lucky enough to work on a book celebrating the 150th anniversary too, and you did a brilliant event where you ran old steam trains in the existing tube tunnels. It was incredible to see.
Oh man, Mark, I mean, that has got to be the high point of my museum career. We worked with Quainton Railway Museum to restore the only operational Metropolitan Railway steam locomotive to working order. And we got the oldest Metropolitan Railway underground carriage, which was a literal shed, and we restored it into a working vehicle and acquired some other carriages at the time from the Bluebell Railway, lent us some, and then we put them into the Underground to recreate the steam experience of travelling on the Underground in the 1890s. And the technical problems of doing that should have been overwhelming, but TfL and the unions in TfL were all absolutely on board, and we were able to pull off this sort of once-in-a-lifetime experience.
I was very fortunate to go on the trial trip
of it, which was 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was there with some other well-known individuals from the world of transport. And you were just there going through these darkened stations, the whistle of the steam train. I mean, unbelievable, unbelievable scenes.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll never forget seeing those steam trains coming into, I believe it was Moorgate Station. Just such a thrill.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I think you were at the London Transport Museum for about 12 years. Is that right, David?
Something like that. Probably just a little bit less. But yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Where did you end up going next?
So after that, I went to the National Army Museum in Sloane Square. And I was there for 3 years. I was director of collections there. And I was working with them on the development of their lottery bid. But I left the museum there before it reopened.
And I believe you created a book about posters of the First World War around about that time. Is that correct?
I did, yeah. I couldn't sort of help myself. To be perfectly fair with you, Mark, it wasn't really my job at that time to do books. But I was looking at their incredible collection. Their store is in Stevenage, just outside North London. And for anyone interested in objects from the past, it's a playground of massive reserve collection. And they have a good poster collection. And I thought, well, I've got to do a book about First World War posters. Because, of course, it was the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the First World War at that time.
Rude not to. So, this is amazing stuff, David, and there's still loads more to discuss. You've told us all about your books, and there's a bit of a theme to some of them, wonderful pictorial posters. Tell us about your projects to help more people discover the joys of posters, please, David.
Well, after I left museums about 10 years ago now, I wanted to set up a business just about antique posters. And on the one hand, it's a business, 20th Century Posters, which sells posters, but it's also via the website an opportunity to have blog posts and guest writers talking about the history of posters, which is of enormous interest to me. So it's a bit of a dual thing that I do now.
What range of posters do you offer now, David?
Well, I started off essentially with what I knew about, so sort of travel posters and mainly sort of British stuff. But now I sell essentially 20th century posters. My focus is still on British graphic design history, because that's really where my interests are. But I do all sorts of travel posters, as well as propaganda, art, music, poster, theatre, a very broad range. And my interests have expanded exponentially in the last few years, as I've become exposed to more types of graphic design language, different types of posters.
It really was the pinnacle, wasn't it, the 20th century of experimentation in graphic design and typography and lettering and printing styles. I mean, I've seen your website. It's just resplendent with an incredible history of design, really.
Well, that's right. You can sort of move from the sort of visual language of travel posters with the sort of dreamlike views, the vistas that they present of Britain or the continents as a place to visit, to the sort of very radical language of a contemporary poster artist like Peter Kennard, who has produced extraordinary protest posters, especially about the campaign for nuclear disarmament. Posters as a medium, as a way of communicating, are still quite vital. I still see in London today incredible modern poster art, and I think it is quite a dynamic medium still.
Oh, that period of, I suppose it was called agitprop, wasn't it? I suppose, yeah. In the 80s, of people like David King and all those designers behind things.
Absolutely.
Like City Limits, their way of communicating through, generally through typography, was astounding, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I think David King, you mentioned, I think he's one of the greatest of our post-war poster designers. A big name in graphic design, perhaps not as well known as he should be, but his stuff for the sort of anti-Nazi movement, but also for the anti-apartheid movement, was really powerful. And it's the sort of posters that if you were shown them, you would recognise them, even if you didn't know the name of the designer.
Yeah, instantly. That was a real style of the time, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
And what kind of styles of posters? I mean, I can hear the things that you love. What styles of posters are most loved and bought by the general public, David?
Well, I think nostalgia and place play a big part in people's buying habits. So, you know, a travel poster from somewhere where you love, somewhere you grew up, somewhere perhaps where you were a student or, you know, worked, that's quite a powerful thing to have in your home. So that's very popular. But also personal autobiography. If you were really into, The Cure in the early 80s and you went to some gigs, having a poster from one of those gigs now in older middle age is a great thing you can have. So there's that sort of buyer. And then there are also specialist collectors, and they're looking for particular designers. People like Edward McKnight Cowper, who was probably the greatest poster artist working in Britain in the 20th century. So there are specialists, and then there are people looking for unusual interior design, often with a link to their own lives.
And what sort of prices are things going for these days? I mean, I presume that's a difficult question to ask, because something very, very rare can go for thousands. But if you wanted to find a nice poster to go in your living room or whatever, what would you be talking about, thousands or hundreds?
I think hundreds. So you get headline figures, right, from auctions or from, you see online, where something is thousands of pounds for a particular item. But if you've got, say, between 200 and sort of 500 to spend, you're going to get something exceptional for that price. Something which doesn't survive in quantity and might be very personal to you. And there are certain sorts of posters that are still very undervalued. So art exhibition posters, for example, some types of music posters, still less than £100, maybe 40 years old, and look tremendous.
And you're going to find something that's individual to you and is going to make your place say something about you rather than something you bought off an Athena shop or something.
That's right. Although, interestingly, I have for the first time got a couple of Athena posters on my stock book. Posters produced by Athena in the 1960s and 70s that are now emblematic of that era. I'm thinking, for example, do you know the poster of Che Guevara?
Oh, yes.
That was in every student's room in the 70s and even into the 80s. And there's another one of a soldier who has been shot and his arms are upwards to the sky and it says, "Why?" with a question mark above it. Well, all of these are by Athena.
Right.
And they have all become sort of cultural icons of the 70s. So, yeah, I do get that stuff as well now.
And that's just a real indication of something that's ephemera, something that today or a few years ago we saw and thought, well, that probably won't have any value in a few years' time. Suddenly, 20, 30, 50 years later, everyone thinks, well, that's emblematic of the moment.
You see that particularly recently with punk posters, which not considered to be particularly special. Suddenly, the market for that has gone incredible, especially for the posters designed for the Sex Pistols and bands like, you know, The Slits and others of that late 70s era. I certainly didn't see that coming, but I could completely understand own a bit of that pop culture history.
Now, you just almost answered another question there. What if someone's listening at home, they've got something rolled up in a loft somewhere?
Yeah.
How would they approach you or other people to figure out whether it, A, has any value or whether they should put it up themselves?
Well, I get asked this pretty much every week. And if people get in touch with me, I get back to them straight away and say, your posters are valuable or they have a value and it's this value. Or as polite as I can, hang on to those for the time being. The market hasn't quite reached that type of poster yet. But if you have some stuff that you want to sell, either get in touch with a legitimate dealer or approach an auction that has a reputation for dealing in design. What I would say to listeners is don't put your stuff in a general auction or even on eBay. It won't be seen or appreciated, and you might be disappointed with the price that it fetches.
And how would people go about finding you and your shop as well?
Well, I am both online and a physical gallery. So my website is 20th Century Posters, and my shop of the same name is in Islington, North London, in Cross Street. And I'm on all the sort of social media platforms, particularly Instagram and X.
posting, I have to say, some of the most riveting and enthralling images, many of which I didn't even know were such beautiful posters. David, thank you so much. It's been so interesting.
Thank you, Mark.
A fellow transport history and poster enthusiast.
It's a pleasure, Mark.
Well, look, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this at home as much as I have. Thanks for joining us, David. And you can find David Bowne's books on your usual search engine. And you can visit his shop online at 20thcenturyposters.com. That's the word 20th spelled out. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications, and history. So please do join us then.